Today is August 1st, 2007. We are at the Atlantic Coast Bank at 8th and Center Streets in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing today Lieutenant Commander Ernest Joseph Malbuff, United States Navy, retired. Commander Malbuff was born on the 14th of February, 1939, in Webster, Massachusetts. My name is Don Hill, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Also attending this interview session is the following individual, Mr. Gerhard Tam, who is the equipment operator. I will now begin the interview. Ernie, tell us, if you will, please, where you were, what you were doing. You had just turned 17 when you enlisted in the Navy. Take us, if you will, through that 30-plus year journey.
Well, I was in the process of graduating from high school, or getting ready to, and a friend of mine said he was going to join the Navy and become a musician. And for some reason or other, I thought that was a good idea for me to go in and learn a trade. And with my family background, there was no thought of college, plus the high school education I'd had, which leaned towards business and commercial administration, things like that. I just didn't think of college. So I went into the Navy to become a printer or a lithographer. When I got to boot camp, after I'd raised my hand and sworn my allegiance to the Navy, my classification interview discovered that LI school had been closed. There was no more LI school.
So LI being lithographer.
Lithographer, right. And so the interviewer said, well, since you know how to type, how would you like to be a yeoman or a personnelman? No, not a yeoman or a... there was another rate at the time. I'm digressing. I said, well, when you're sitting there in front of authority, just go along with whatever they're telling you. I said, well, that sounds like a good idea. So I ended up in Yeoman A School following the boot camp. And
that was at Bainbridge?
That was at Bainbridge.
Where did you go to boot camp?
I went to a boot camp at Bainbridge also.
Oh, really? Okay, thank you.
Yeah, the Naval Training Center. And boot camp was an experience, but between boot camp and Yeoman A School, I did a four-month temporary duty stint at the old Naval Auxiliary Air Station, Mayport, Florida, which introduced me to the beginnings of the Navy. And that's why I saw my first aircraft carrier, the USS Forrestone. And it was kind of eerie sight because I saw it at night across the turning, across the basin there, and it was all lit up, and they were loading bombs to go to Lebanon. That was the old Lebanon crisis back in the 50s. And that added a kind of a flare of excitement to my early days in the Navy. And then I actually saw the carriers coming in and out of there. And it was the 4 months of mess cooking. Nobody wanted to mess cook, but I volunteered for the extra months since I was leaving. And it was a good job. So, and from there I went to Bainbridge. I think it was a five-week Yeoman A School. And while I'd been at Mayport, I'd met a young lady here from Jacksonville. And so when they came to issuing orders, back then they didn't tell you where you're going. They asked you where you'd like to go. They had a whole list of orders and just said, who wants to go to Patrol Squadron 16 in Jacksonville? And I raised my hand, so I got my orders back to Jacksonville. And Jim thought it was pretty neat to actually the Navy issues orders anymore. Yeah, at the time. Well, later on I found out that wasn't quite the case. And I did a tour with the Patrol Squadron 16, the War Eagles, at Naval Air Station.
What were they called again?
The War Eagles.
The War Eagles.
Yeah. And made my first deployment with them to Keflavik, Iceland. And well, after I'd been there about, only maybe a month and a half, I got orders issued back from out of 16 to Fighter Squadron 22 back to Naval Air Station, Jacksonville. And which after I got there, I was wondering why, because they got decommissioned after 2 months. And I think they just needed help closing out the records and packing up the boxes. So my next set of orders was to attack Squadron 12 out of NAS Cecil Field. And that was VA-12, the Flying Ubangis.
That was their real name?
That was their name. Actual title.
What kind of aircraft were they flying?
They were flying the old A-4D-2 Skyhawks.
Yes.
And a great little plane. And with VA-12, made my first Mediterranean deployment, and, which was kind of a highlight in my career. We made that in the USS Forrestal, which was the first carrier I'd ever seen. So there's kind of a connection there. And following that tour, I finished up as a second-class yeoman in VA-12 and left the Navy for about a year. So I was going to really become a civilian, become a millionaire and all that. A little time.
5 seconds, Minister. Okay.
So I got out in 1960, January of 1960, finishing up on the nearly about three and a half years tour, and entered civilian life. By then I'd been married. We got married in 1959, October. So I'd been married a short time, and went into civilian life, banged around a few jobs and all that, and ended up living back up in Webster, Massachusetts, my hometown. And I think I had a spiritual awakening on Christmas Eve of 1960. My wife and I had gone to midnight mass, and as the priest was coming down the aisle presenting the Christ child to the people, he got along right next to our pew and turned to me with the little, statue of Christ. And the first thing that crossed my mind was, I'm going back into the Navy. And that was the beginning of the rest of my career. Christmas at that time was on a weekend, and the following Monday, they found me at the post office up in Worcester, Massachusetts, pounding on the recruiter's door, so to speak. Said, let me in, And so I went in come one to re-enlist, and they handed me they said, well, you're a former yeoman, here's the papers, type them up, So I typed up my own re-enlisting papers at the recruiting station. And went back in, went through a couple of weeks at Brooklyn Naval Station waiting for the my orders.
Did you have to give up the stripe? Or did they take
you
back?
Yeah. I gave up the stripe. I came back in as a YN-3.
Yeah.
And but I only had to wait a year take the test again to go back up rather than doing a full two years, I think it was at that time. Here, my first orders at that from to kick me off of that phase of the rest of my career was to the U.S. Naval Support Force Antarctica in Washington, D.C., Operation Deep Sea Staff. So, went there, and then I made a deployment to McMurdo Sound, Antarctica with them. Actually, to Christchurch, New Zealand, and then they sent me down to the ice for 9 weeks to support the Admiral and the rest of the staff down there. And that was pretty exciting, arriving there. It was 40 degrees below zero the day we arrived. And then it was interesting because during the rest of my stay, the weather warmed up, became summertime, and 10 degrees was short sleeve weather, because you did not feel cold whatsoever. And that was interesting. You know, my first penguins, and walruses, and giant seals, and all that. And I finished up that cruise in, I call it a cruise, but it was a deployment. Rest time in Christchurch, and then we returned to Washington. And the following deployment, when it came time again to deploy again, they left me in Washington, support the Washington staff, which was just a caretaker type thing. And from there, I did a short stint at submarine school in New London, and I dropped out of that after a couple of weeks and went to the USS Intrepid. And that was in 1964, and stayed with the Intrepid until it was May of 1965, and got a set of orders to Office of Chief Naval Operations, CNO, and OPNAV in Washington.
And were you deployed on Intrepid with a squadron or a ship's company?
Ship's company, yeah, on that. And, during that time, we were in out quite a bit. We had midshipman crews up to Quebec, Canada. And then later on, we did workups with the squadrons and that, down to mostly through the Caribbean. So I got my first taste of Gitmo fleet training group there with them. And all the horror stories are true about going through FTG and Gitmo on a ship, you know. And prior to, and they were scheduled for a med deployment. Prior to that is when I got transferred out of there to shore duty in Washington, OPNAV. That was 1964. During that time, I made first class YN1, which I picked up YN2 back in when I was on the deep freeze staff. And then, excuse me. As a YN1, I decided that I was working for some great LDOs, limited duty officer types, who encouraged me to pursue an officer career. Plus, I had a good friend and mentor on the deep freeze staff, who were YN1, who went to YNC and then to LDO ensign. And I kind of looked up to him and thought, well, I'd like to be like Larry, you know, an officer. And then when I got to OPNAV, the same thing, I had some great mentors behind me there. So I went ahead and applied for LDO. I basically skipped chief, even though I had to still take the chief test and pass that to get the warrant officer. Actually, I said, well, LDO, actually warrant officer. So in June of 1967, I got promoted to warrant officer. I just went to Newport for what we call knife and fork school. And in 8 weeks of basic, you know, how to be an officer type thing. And my first orders from there were to the USS Columbus guided missile cruiser CG-12 out of Norfolk, which was interesting because one of my mentors in OPNAV had been the ship's active personnel officer on board Columbus also. So it's kind of like, you know, something to go by.
Now your selection for warrant officer took you to W1, I take it?
Yes, W1.
Which doesn't exist anymore.
That's right.
And you were in the admin category of those warrant officers, is that
ship's
correct?
Clerk, yeah. Ship's clerk. Called a warrant officer, ship's clerk.
Got it.
Yeah. And those were the cross quills.
Yes.
Insignia. Yeah, when I went to Columbus, my first job was ship secretary and supporting the XO, primarily the executive officer, and it seemed that way anyways, even though I did support the CO2.
Could you briefly describe the duties of a ship's secretary?
Ship secretary basically the ship's administrator, primarily responsible for the executive officer's office, the captain's office, the post office, public affairs office, the print shop, you know, several other things, public affairs, things like that. Getting the mail in, getting the mail out, and all that stuff, you know. Several of the chief working for me, and a couple of, you know, yeoman types. And after a year of that, transferred into the personnel office, which was the normal progression. Whenever one new one came in, went to the ship sec job. And after a year, when the personnel officer rolled out, ship sec moved up to the personnel officer. And that was maintaining all the enlisted records. And actually became the division officer for X Division, which included the former ship sec office and all that stuff. With the Columbus and the four med deployments, and that was done in Vietnam while Vietnam was going on. And the reason we never went to Vietnam is because the Columbus was in such poor, you know, shape engineering wise that we could not make any extended deployments like that. They brought her around from the West Coast and just used her as a turnaround ship for, you know, for the Mediterranean. Mediterranean site, which in one respect we liked, even though there was actually less sea time than if we'd gone to.
Was Columbus the flagship for the 6th Fleet?
Well, it was the flagship for the cruiser, crew desflot, cruiser destroyer flotilla, Admiral. The 6th Fleet ship was a separate, which was homeported there permanently.
Yes.
All the time. So that was, you know, four mid cruises and her. And while there, I made one off W-2 and got promoted to W-2 and rolled out of there in December of 1970 and got transferred to Norfolk to the Enlisted Personnel Distribution Office, U.S. Atlantic Fleet, better known as EPTALANT. And while there, I was the Fleet Shore and Overseas Assignment Officer and Assistant Requisition Management Officer, which my title saw the issuing of orders to the shore duty commands in the Atlantic Fleet and also some of the overseas activities that were attached to us. And then the little minor activities like the Fleet Act side of the old Antigua and places like that. And while in Columbus, I had applied for LDO, Limited Duty Officer Program, and got selected while I was at, shortly after I arrived at EPTALANT, and was looking forward to being promoted to officer, ensign. And lo and behold, in that waiting period, the Navy changes program, and instead if you had previous time as a warrant officer, they felt that it was denigrating to somebody to promote them to an ensign status. So I went from W-2 to O-2 in that period as a lieutenant junior grade. I did 2 years at EPTALANT in Norfolk and received a set of orders to Naval Station Guantanamo Bay, Cuba as the admin officer down there. I went down there to 1973 and did a 2-year tour there until 1975 as the Naval Station Administrative Officer. And that was pretty exciting, being in Gitmo, and really enjoyed the fishing, swimming, snorkeling.
Was that an unaccompanied tour?
No, that was accompanied.
It was accompanied, yeah. So thus the two-year tour.
Yep, and matter of fact, there was no waiting. The wife went, you know, directly. We didn't, we had housing waiting for us and all that. So really, really enjoyed that. In July of 75, I guess it was, I transferred out of there and went to London, England, to the Commander-in-Chief U.S. Naval Forces Europe, Centcoast Navy, your staff. And I was a fleet personnel officer there for the 6th Fleet. London was not my cup of tea, so to speak. I always felt that I enjoyed my time on board ship better than I did my London tour. I just didn't care for staff duty. The job entailed fleet personnel officer managing the, you know, resources, personnel resources for all the commands around the shore commands, and then also had my fingers into, you know, fleet and ship status and things like that. For probably not so much as moving people around, but to, you know, see what the fleet readiness status was, you know, part of my duties involved being on the Inspector General's team, you know, several trips to different, you know, bases, Naples and Sardinia and Sicily and here and there to for inspections and things like that. 2 years in there, in September, my stepdad had protracted a critical illness, so I asked for a humanitarian transfer out of London and ended up at the training center at Newport, Rhode Island for a couple of months while the family situation was straightened out. And from there, I got orders to the USS Warsaw as the ship's admin assistant, administrative officer. And in between there, I got stashed for a while at Claw 1, Light Attack Wing 1 out of Cecil Field for about 4 months, I guess it was. And reported to the Warsaw in January of 1979, made my last commit cruise on board the Forrestal. So I guess my heart's always been with the Forrestal, being the first carrier I ever saw, make my first med cruise on the Forrestal with a squadron, and then made my last med cruise as the ship's company on the Forrestal.
And in there, between London and Newport and Cecil and back to Mayport, you must have made lieutenant.
Yeah, I got promoted to lieutenant while I was at Naval Station Guantanamo.
Aha, yeah. Ahead of that, okay.
Yeah, I went there as a GAG.
Right.
Got promoted at Naval Station Guantanamo. Went to London as a lieutenant. And the Forrestal as a lieutenant, got promoted to lieutenant commander on the Forrestal.
When date?
I can't remember what the date was. You know, I'd have to look back in my biography somewhere. But I left there as a lieutenant commander, and I was going to supposed to retire, and I thought I was going to retire. And when I picked up lieutenant commander, I decided, well, gee, another couple of years wouldn't be bad. No. So I called my detailer, which turned out we were in Gitmo at the time. So I called them from Gitmo, and they said, well, how'd you like to be OIC at the PSD in Gitmo? So I said, you know, great. So I finished my tour in January of 81 at on Forrestal, and report reported to PSC Guantanamo as the officer in charge in February of 1980.
Would you explain just briefly, please, Ernie, the PSD concept and what it took the place of?
PSD concept, actually what it did was it took the, it became actually the one-stop shopping for pay, personnel, and transportation matters for all the commands. Rather than each individual command at a base maintaining its own certain enlisted and officer service records, they basically located all of them at a personnel support detachment pass office. And it was a concept that was initiated in 1975 by the Navy, and then actually in October 1978 is when they implemented it Navy-wide. And, it was kind of becoming an officer, the officer in charge at Gitmo. I was the second one there, and for me it was a highlight of my career, you know, going from a high school senior recruit at Bainbridge and ending up as officer in charge at, you know, at that unit. And I think that was one of my finest tours, the ones that I enjoyed the best.
How long were you there? 3 years?
I was there just under 3 years.
Yes.
I left there in December of 1983 and transferred to the Naval Education Training Program Development Center at Soffley Field, the old Naval Examining Center.
Pensacola.
Pensacola. And there I was the base operations support officer, which kind of a catch-all for admin officer, personnel officer, public works, monitoring public works officer, and security, and things like that. And I was there until I retired in September of 1987 as lieutenant commander.
So over 31 years of...
31 with broken service.
With broken service.
Yes, like 30 active.
Okay, hold on.
Ernie, tell me, please, if you would share with me some thoughts about some of those mentors you mentioned earlier who made a real difference in your life and in your Navy career, if you would, please.
I think the first one was actually that I've thought about as being a mentor was his name was Larry Thorstenson. And as I mentioned, he was on the Deep Free staff with me. He was... I was a YN3 and YN2. Came in as a YN1, got promoted directly to YNC shortly after that. And very 4-0 type looking sailor all the time. Had an attitude about him which was 4-0 all the time. I wouldn't say he had a broomstick up his butt, never did that. But he was just somebody that, you know, knew what he was talking about. And his attitude, his leadership, made me look up to him. And I think, as I said before, that I wanted to be an officer like he ended up being, you know. As a matter of fact, I tried to, when I got left Intrepid, when I left submarine school and setting for orders, I actually went to Intrepid, which is where he was supposed to have gone to, and then he got transferred to another ship instead. So I was trying to go to work for him again. And I guess somebody else that really helped me along in my career and put me on the road was Lieutenant Dick Gilbert at OPNAV. I worked for him as secretary there. He's the one that had served on the Columbus, the ship that I had gone to. And prior to him, there was another lieutenant in that office by the name of Art Stone, I believe his name was. And I hope I've got that name right. He was another great mentor that I looked up to quite a bit.
Good for you.
And somebody else in OPNAV, too, that... His name was Lieutenant Commander Pat Grillo, and he worked for one of the admirals there. He kind of pushed me along, oversaw my application for warrants, and just followed me along for a couple of years after that. And so I think those were four or five that I've always keep in my mind.
Thank you, Ernie. That's great. As we get near the end of this very, very interesting interview, tell us how you and your family ultimately wound up in Nassau County and in Fernandina Beach, if you would, please.
Well, my wife's originally from Jacksonville, and courting her, we used to come up here once in a while to the beach, to Fernandina, so we knew about it. And when I got my orders to the Forestall, we decided we didn't want to necessarily live around Mayport. We wanted to kind of get away from the beaten track. So we decided to live up here in Fernandina, moved up here. And so my tour on the Forestall from 81 to 84. I'm sorry. Yeah, 81 to 80. No, 79 to 81. We lived up here. And I traveled back and forth, went down to caught the ferry every morning, and caught the ferry every evening coming back. And I really enjoyed that, because the hours we had on the ship would get off at 2:30. So I'd stop at the little Admiral over there at Mayport, pick up a beer, and ride the ferry over. By the time I got home, I was ready to cut the grass. And after I retired, we actually moved to Rockledge, Florida, from Pensacola. I retired in Pensacola, we moved to Rockledge, Florida, with the thoughts I was going to possibly go to work for NASA down there, trying to get a job down there at the Space Center. We'd been in that area once or twice and thought we really liked it. Well, I never got to NASA. Ended up getting my real estate license and selling real estate there for a while. And then we got tired of the weather. It seemed to be the same all the time, hot. So we moved back up. We sold the house and moved back up here to Fernandina, which was only supposed to be a temporary measure. We arrived here in 1994, and we're still here. So that's how we ended up back in Fernandina.
Any questions here?
That's it.
Thank you for sharing your recollections with us for the benefit of our nation, Ernie. It was very interesting, and thank you for your honorable service to our country. This concludes the interview with Ernest J. Malbeth.